Hello and welcome to another episode of Cosmic Echo, a Tailor podcast. This podcast applies a scientific viewpoint in the strange and bizarre phenomenon that happens in our lives when we sleep in altered states. In this episode, we speak with Robert Forte. He began his work with psychedelics as a student of Frank Baron, co-founder of the Harvard Psilocybin Project. He obtained his master's degrees under Mircea Eliade and his collaborations with many of the leaders in the field of psychedelics, including Gordon Wasson, Timothy Leary, and Huston Smith. He's also the former director of the Albert Hofmann Foundation, and he teaches at the California Institute of Integral Studies. Robert is also the author of Entheogens and the Future of Religion, which examines the ancient and modern use of psychedelic drugs, calling for a safe and legal availability of the entheogens for spiritual seekers. His book includes contributions by Albert Hofmann, Terence McKitta, Rex Strassman, Gordon Wasson, and Jack Kornfield. If you're interested in this episode and would like to hear more about Robert Forte and his work, you can visit the website at tailleaders.com/CEpodcast, and there you can find a number of links that will take you to Robert Forte's work. Additionally, you can support this podcast by clicking on the Patreon page, which is located at the same website. Well, without further ado, let's get to the interview. How are you doing today, Robert?
Well, I'm doing just fine. It's nice to have this conversation with you. And let me start by making a couple of corrections.
Okay.
So first of all, calling me Professor Robert Forte is a little bit of an exaggeration. While it's true that I have served on the faculties of two University of California and presently as adjunct at California Institute of Integral Studies, I'm not really technically a professor. I'm a lecturer. I'm a researcher. So just to be clear, there. Number one. Number two. I'm not exactly the author of Timothy Leary Outside Looking In.
Oh, okay.
It is an anthology that I am the editor and compiler of and author of some pieces.
Okay.
The Road to Eleusis, the second book that you mentioned, is a very important book in the history of psychedelic drugs. That is written by Albert Hofmann, Gordon Wasson, and Carl Ruck. It was published back in 1978. And I, through a relationship with Gordon Wasson and Albert Hofmann, brought the book back into print with additional material. So to be precise, I'm the editor of the subsequent new editions of this book. And then my third book is called Entheogens and the Future of Religion, also a collected work that is the result of conferences and interviews and conversations that I've had with people dating back almost 30 years about this subject of psychedelic drugs and what could be done about them in the modern world. So how about that?
All right. Well, I guess that's a good way to start there. How did you actually get... I mean, I noticed in your latest book, The Entheogens and the Future Religion, you have a lot of writings from different authors and stuff. So how did you come about to get in contact with different people, such as the people that are actually in your book?
Well, that was just a matter of good luck, I guess. I was I had set about to study the phenomena of religion in the world. I'd had mystical experiences when I was a little boy, naturally, in nature. And I was growing up in the 60s. I was never really that interested in psychedelic drugs because it seemed to me that the people who took them just got kind of weird. You know, they kind of really departed from ordinary reality. I didn't notice anything of great benefit in their lives. I was kind of frightened by them. But I'd had these own experiences of just kind of a oneness with nature, and it's very magical. So it drew me to things like studying meditation and yoga. And then in that inquiry, I learned that psychedelic drugs were very fundamental in the history of religion and in the development of these techniques of yoga and meditation. So that's when I began to pay attention to them. And I was a very studious guy. I liked to read. I was in an Ivy League college, and I began to read about Timothy Leary and began to just kind of make these connections. And it was just a matter of luck, really, that I moved to California and to finish my education at the University of California. And I connected there with Frank Barron, who became my professor. And Frank Barron was Timothy Leary's best friend, who, I mean, Frank was also one of the most important and respected psychologists of the last century, actually. He was the most cited professor in the University of California and a real respected researcher into the psychology of creativity. And I learned a lot from him. And he kind of took me under his wing, and he, you know, learned of my interest in meditation and consciousness, and he urged me to deepen my knowledge of psychedelic drugs, and so I did, and eventually he introduced me to Tim, who became a, you know, a teacher and a friend, and, you know, Leary is, of course, such a major character in psychedelic drugs over the past 50 years that I was, you know, I just felt like I was really lucky. And because then, you know, Frank urged me to organize a conference in 1981 at the University of California. And at that time, 1981, there was a real lull in the field of psychedelics. Much hadn't gone on. There had been really no academic conferences since all this activity in the 60s. Things had really quieted down. And so wanted to stir that up again, I guess, or something. Anyway, he asked me to do this work with Peter Stafford, who is another very important and brilliant man who's written, I think, the best book on the subject. It's called The Psychedelics Encyclopedia by Peter Stafford. Hmm. We teamed up and we organized with a bunch of other beautiful people in the Santa Cruz area this major conference on psychedelic drugs called Colloquium 2, The Future of Consciousness Research. And we invited, you know, everybody who had done any kind of credible work with the subject, from Timothy Leary, who represented the kind of popular movement, to Stanislav Grof, who is, you know, the world's leading theoretician and researcher into states of psychedelic consciousness. And they came, and all these people in the middle, I mean, Sasha Shulgin came, and Terrence Smith, who was just this kind of, you know, bearded weirdo, came, Janiger, Los Angeles, and Andrew Weil, and all these people, and it showed that there was this amazing excitement about this subject still, even though it would be death to an academic career to pick it up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I began to meet all these people, and I was on my way to the University of Chicago to study the history of religion with Mircea Eliade, but Stan Grof invited me to come to Esalen instead and to learn more deeply about psychedelics. So I went down to Sir. And again, you know, I could just go on. It just keeps unfolding from there. I was asked to organize other conferences and went over to Switzerland and became a friend of Albert Hoffman's, who, you know, kind of treated me like my grandfather for many years. And, I got a real inside look at this very, very mysterious subject. So how did you get into it?
I wasn't as fortunate as you knowing a bunch of amazing people that I've read about, but pretty much I got interested because of my sleep research, and I found a connection between entheogens and sleep, and I wanted to dig deeper into that. And through Richard Strassman's kind of work with DMT and the possibility of it being produced in the pineal gland. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that after a lot of reading and a lot of research, I guess, into the safeties and the precautions and things like that to dealing with DMT and ayahuasca, I decided that ayahuasca should be my first psychedelic experience, I guess. And that pretty much made me understand that psychedelics were nothing like dreaming, and that this was something completely different. And because of that, oddly enough, it gave me a lot of healing that I didn't expect to get. I expected to find out, the connection between dreaming and psychedelics, and what I got was the ridding of my depression, and a new kind of inspiration for life and drive, and a lot more relaxation for my own personal, I guess, self, and almost a religion. So I used to be a pretty hardcore Christian, and since then I pretty much moved from that to agnostic, and I just don't really know what's going on anymore, but feel pretty good about that. And it's made me want to continue learning, and I think that's probably the biggest thing that I've learned from psychedelics is not to ever stop learning about them, and the nature of reality, I guess. So very different from what you've experienced, I guess, through
Well, it's
your
not different. You've just chosen to talk about a slightly different part of it, and I have to say that I'm so heartened by what you say because that was so beautiful that you are an example of how these magical things can work. And
Thanks.
so many, you said so many things in that little introduction that I want to go into and talk about. Like, I mean, I've become so fascinated now with sleep. As you probably know, maybe you know that in at least some of the yogic language, that the state of the deepest state of sleep is akin to the highest state of consciousness, which they call nirbija samadhi. This profound immersion in the sea of undisturbed consciousness is really at the root of a lot of the world's mystical traditions. And I've become interested in that lately, and it's kind of different from what we think of with psychedelic stuff, because when you take a psychedelic, there's an activation of the whole collective unconscious, and all this stuff starts happening. And it's kind of the complete opposite of the very, very deep state of sleep and rest. And so anyway, that would be a whole conversation in itself.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's interesting that you talked about how you start off with type of meditating and things like that, and how you combine them together, I guess, your use of psychedelics along with your experience of meditating. And how they affected each other through that process, I guess.
Well, I got interested in meditation, funny, for very prosaic reasons, it seems, and that I have this other life, which is an athlete, and especially interested in the game of golf, which I've been playing since I was kind of young. And it's a very mental game, and it's a game where once you learn the kind of basic physical move, it's all about kind of controlling the mind, sort of like the game of pool, perhaps. And so I became interested in practicing meditation to learn techniques for calming the mind. And it was in I first began to practice transcendental meditation, but then I started to study the history of religion. And it's transcendental meditation had such an interesting effect on my life, and I all of a sudden became a straight A student, and I had this kind of maturity happened, and I wondered who figured this stuff out. Indian guys figure out meditation, and this simple technique for calming the mind would so much improve your life. And then I learned about the history of these things, and I found that they came from mushroom experiences. And that's a fact. There are a lot of controversial facts in the history of religion, and I've gotten to study the history of religion quite thoroughly. I went to divinity school at the University of Chicago, where I spent a lot of time learning this. And one of the I was with Mircea Eliade, who's one of the great scholars in the history of religion. And there are the oldest thing in Indian religion are these oldest writings are called the Vedas, which the oldest part of those talk about these ancient ceremonies called the fire sacrifice, where they drank this stuff called soma, which gave them about the whole nature of reality and how human beings figure in this wild cosmic adventure. And these were all the result of these visions from taking these mushrooms or drinking this stuff called soma, and nobody knew what it was. And then, finally, after thousands of years of research by people trying to figure out these ancient secrets, a theory emerged that soma was originally a psychedelic mushroom, and that something happened in the history of religion back in ancient India that soma disappeared. And so these ancient mystics tried to figure out other ways to get into the trances and the visionary states that were caused by these mushrooms. And that's where all of these techniques of Indian religion originally unfold out of, is looking to replace the original psychedelic inspiration, which was soma. And so, that's kind of really far out an important thing. And that was one of the things that drew me into the subject of psychedelics.
That's very interesting that you made that connection. And then, I mean, how did you move to actually, I mean, there's an interest, but then there's the, I guess, jumping off the rock into the water kind of thing, from 100 feet above. So how did you get from being interested to actually putting the substance in your mouth?
The first thing I did was go on a long meditation retreat, a 3-month meditation retreat, and practicing Vipassana meditation. Then I came back to California, and Guy showed up with some LSD. And I took it, and I'm a little wary about talking about this because one of the things I notice in this modern enthusiasm about the subject is a real curiosity about experiences. And in the mystical traditions, in the historical traditions that these substances were originally used in among human beings, you never talked about your experiences. This is why they come from a whole body of, they're called mysteries. Psychedelics are part of ancient mysteries. The word mystery comes from the Greek word mystis or something, which means literally to be silent about. And that you're not supposed to, or it also means to shut the senses. And that, but I like this word to be silent about because I think one of the very important things about visions and about using psychedelics is to try to get into a frame of mind where you're receiving a vision. And when you are kind of primed from the outside, I don't know, this idea about grabbing for visions, and activating a kind of, the best visions come when you're not looking for them, is kind of what I'm saying, and this is sort of a paradox that's used by hungry ghosts made in terms of a broader picture of the spiritual path. Is that clear?
Yeah, maybe it's more of a Western thing where we're so obsessed with the visuals, I guess, of things. Like, we watch tons of movies, we watch TV, we want what it looks like kind of thing. We want to experience the entertainment rather than the emotion. Like maybe in past religious experiences, it was more about the actual experience of the emotion. Maybe that's why we're kind of keen on going in that direction, I guess. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't know.
Okay. So in your book, Entheogens, entheogens and the future of religion, in one of the articles that Sterling talks about, where he's talking about religious prosecution, and he goes into depth about that. What is your view on the religious prosecution today, and what you'd like to see maybe come of that in the future?
Well, wow. Okay, so you're opening up the subject of the kind of the politics of, or as Timothy,
Definitely.
one of the best essays I think that Timothy Leary ever wrote was called "The Politics of Ecstasy," meaning not the drug ecstasy, but the politics of ecstasy, meaning the religious experience and how this has been. How this has been organized or controlled by either churches or by governments. So that chapter by Eric Sterling in Entheogens and the Future of Religion is an exploration of the idea. Like, so here we have the United States of America, which, according to the official story, was founded by these pilgrims seeking freedom of religion from the authoritarian churches of England and Europe. People came here looking to feel like that the government had no business in their own private religious lives. People should be free to worship and experience as they wish. And so, now jump forward to this period, and we have psychedelic drugs. Now, all scholars agree that these substances, whatever we're talking about, from LSD, which has its roots in ancient Greek mysteries, to ayahuasca or mushrooms. These are part of the largest body of religion on the planet known as shamanism. Throughout, the longest stretches of history, we don't even really know how long, for tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years, human beings have communed with spirit using these plants. And so it's really so fucking ironic that here we are in this country that supposedly on based freedom of religion is that these substances are forbidden and illegal, and the people use them in a religious context are sent to jail. That book was meant to just kind of stir this up because, again, when I started doing this work in the 80s, nobody was really talking about this. Now it's very different. Now there's a conversation, but I'm very suspicious.
Seems recently that it might be just because I'm more looking at the subject of psychedelics more often, but it seems like a lot more people are seeking them out and, actively trying to use them as religious kind of substances, going in that direction. Why do you think that maybe that is?
Well, Friedrich, you've again, excuse me, you drop these bombs. One of the things that has struck me over my time I've been watching the subject is the very wide diversity of people that are drawn to these substances and for what reasons. Here we've just started talking about the religious use of them, where they can be used to peer into these mysterious dimensions of consciousness there that are, beyond belief and are the essence of the world's religions. But at the same time, these substances are used by people who have the opposite intention and that use them to contract consciousness. And this is very important to bring this out. And a lot of my colleagues and friends kind of bristle when I enter this conversation, but it is absolutely essential to point out, for example, that the CIA, the American CIA, is actually the largest purveyor of LSD in the history of the world. And so it's important to, take these forays into understanding what the CIA is and what it's has done in the world and why are they using psychedelic drugs. And so I forget, honestly, what piqued my saying this, but because psychedelic drugs have these religious properties, and they surely do, does not mean that every time they are used or if they are propagated in a culture, they are having these expansive effects. Now, this may be a complicated sentence, but maybe you can help me figure it out.
Like maybe that they're searching for that experience, but you know, they're kind of maybe searching the wrong way. They expect something, but they don't always get what they expect.
Well, here, let me come at it this way. Are you familiar with Aldous Huxley?
Yes.
Have you read his book, Brave New World?
I have not read that one, no.
Okay. Well, my friend, my young friend, this would be what your professor would give you, is to read Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, or anybody who's listening who hasn't read Brave New World. You know, Brave New World is on the list of one of the 10 most banned books. And it was it's a very, very important piece of literature that Aldous Huxley wrote back in 1937. Before he knew of psychedelic drugs, in 1937, he wrote a book about a future society that was a totalitarian society. Okay, so it's like 1984, right? If you're familiar with this genre, here is a culture where the people are completely indoctrinated and controlled by a ruling elite that control every important means of education, whether it be the media or the schools or, you know, everything, movies, books. And so they're just programmed. This whole society is programmed by an elite to be obedient and serve their greedy wishes. Mm-hmm. And one of the techniques of this elite in Brave New World, Huxley puts, is a drug that's called Soma. Soma is a drug. When you read it, you'll say, my God, that sounds just like MDMA.
Yeah.
A drug that gives people a temporary experience of everything being okay. Even when everything isn't okay, the people are anesthetized by this sense of goodness that they are just become kind of accustomed to their plight, and they completely abnegate any sense of political responsibility. And also in this culture, this fictional society that Huxley describes, free sex is not just encouraged, but kind of required. The people are fucking their brains out. They're not allowed or encouraged or allowed to have any intimacy or fall in love. They are just encouraged to fuck a lot and to take these drugs whenever they become anxious. And so I'm pointing this out because I think that one of the things that's happening in modern culture is that we are being somified, and that psychedelic drugs are being reintroduced via a kind of secret team behind American government, CIA, Mossad, things like that, that are, you know, making up all these crazy stories that we live our lives by, whether it's Osama bin Laden or, you know, whatever the things are that are in the newspaper. These are all, you know, false realities that are being spun by these people. And we're being fed these drugs and these kind of psychedelic stories that show that you know, all you have to do is take this little pill and you can tune out from this world and everything will be all right. But see, a very important stage is missing here, in that these is that in order to have a really integrated unitive experience, at least in terms of these, I think there is a sense of being involved in the body politic and not letting ourselves be just like these characters in Huxley's novel. Am I making myself clear? What do you
think? Yeah. Well, I mean, I know that from what I've experienced is that, I mean, I haven't experienced too many types of psychedelics or anything. I've pretty much stuck to ayahuasca. So, I mean, I know from ayahuasca, it's definitely not a mind-numbing kind of experience. It's more of like, hey, wake up, you know, get your life together, start doing stuff, you know, start loving each other, you know, a little bit more, like caring about each other because this is all you got kind of thing. So, it's definitely not the one that, that control would be enforced on people. But I do know that a lot of people are actively seeking it out, trying to go to, like Peru and stuff like that in order to gain the experiences. I think it's more of a drive to change their lives. Like they're looking for something, to give them religion that church isn't giving them anymore, to cure their sickness that they've got, I think, from maybe that drug that you're seeking, like sugar and things like that, or the mind-numbing idea of society of where you have to fit, you have to be happy where you fit, and that's all there is, the white picket fence kind of thing. So, but I mean, I know that through history, the government has definitely looked into different types of drugs in order to control people. So I wouldn't, put it past them to try to use something to kind of mellow people out. And, maybe that's why psychedelic drugs are completely illegal, because 'cause they realize that people are, might think for themselves, and people don't like that.
It's a complicated subject. So, I don't know. I just feel like I wish people were more kind of politically engaged.
Yeah,
I feel,
definitely.
maybe that's because I'm some of my oldest. I was born in Boston. I was kind of raised in shadow of these Revolutionary War monuments, where the American system kind of represented a successful evolution, where
Yeah.
democracy prevailed and that we wouldn't be ruled by an elite that kind of drained the Commonwealth. And
Yeah.
so these ideas of a kind of integrated view of human consciousness that would extend out into spiritual dimensions of unity and magical mystery, but also was kind of netted back into the here and now so that we could have a sustainable society. You see, right now we don't have a sustainable society. We have an absolutely insane society where people are, like it's the Kali Yuga, man, where these psychopaths run our government.
Yeah.
And I was originally, one of the things that drew me to psychedelics is that once I figured out what they were, is that they were in the hands of Timothy Leary. Let's go back to Timothy Leary. That he saw them as a means to awaken a radical political revolution in this country. And and one of the things that we see now in the attention that the drugs are getting in the media is that Leary is almost, you read these articles, man, they're formulaic. They always say, oh, the psychedelics are being discovered by scientists to have these therapeutic properties. If it weren't for that Timothy Leary, who made such a mess of this subject back, maybe doctors would be able to use them. But the fact is that Timothy Leary had figured out that if they were used right, they could awaken people from the course that this mind control operation that was being put on American society. And you have, these may sound like crazy things, but beginning in the 40s, people were beginning to organize in a CIA operation called Operation Mockingbird. It's a takeover of the media.
Well, definitely. I mean, I had a chance to take a class where they talk about conspiracy theories and stuff like that in college, where it's from a historian and he knew what he was talking about. And it was definitely an eye opener to realize how many different crazy schemes the government had done in order to try to manipulate people or.
I'm fascinated by this stuff, like how consciousness is. See, we talk about psychedelic drugs and we think about them putting you in an altered state of consciousness. I think what's interesting is that American society is already in an altered state of consciousness. And what the psychedelic drugs are doing is awakening you to a ordinary state of consciousness. I mean, That's really what the goal of religion is. It's not to have an altered state. It's to be here now, kind of thing. I think that these conspiracy theories, like, you can see how deliberately stories and books and movies and educational systems have been devised to keep people thinking in a certain way.
How?
And this is what Leary was very enthusiastically devoted to, is that waking people up to, by taking these drugs, so you can realize the fantastic creative spiritual power of the human being, that you don't have to look outside of you for power. You're your own god and goddess, and that start your own religion and this kind of revolutionary impulse. And that's the beautiful thing about the sacred drugs.
Just saying that to some people would totally freak them out, you know, saying that you can, you know, see yourself being, you know, a god or anything like that. It's not God in the sense that they see it as the Old Testament or the New Testament, you know, the guy in the sky hammering down on people. It's more of like a understanding that, you know, you're connected to each other, and that, you know, life is connected, and that you're part of that whole system of things. I think that people are so obsessed with religion, you know, in the sense of going to church and doing the movements, they don't understand that, you know, they can have a more intimate relationship with God, and that these substances that, you know, they've kind of made illegal themselves through history is something that can do that for them. But and that's means of control too, you know. If you can tell people who their God is and how to worship, then, you know, you kind of have the power. And you studying history, I'm sure you've come up to that understanding quite often.
Yeah, well, that's very well said. And I would just add to that I'm a little concerned now with the current move, like the government approving certain parts of psychedelic research, that it reminds me of the period in the establishment of Christianity. You know, at the very beginning, Christianity was an underground outlaw hippie movement. It was the first hippie movement.
Yeah.
Where they stood out, they renounced the ways of the state, they wanted to live in a way that they turned on, they tuned in, and they dropped out. And they were living peacefully, and they became such a political force, actually, just by dropping out, kind of like Gandhi in India centuries later, that that Rome had to make a decision. And rather than, you know, keep throwing them to the lions, they if you can't beat them, join them. They made Christianity, they accepted it. It was no longer an outlaw religion. It was accepted. It became the state religion. And once that happened, Christianity went from being a peace and love cult to the most destructive thing in the history of the world. And it became the kind of justification for the Inquisition and the slaughtering of all the witches. And this crazy fucking thing happened as soon as, you know, so I say this because, you know, the government that we have today, if the government is approving something, it's probably fucked up, because it's completely and totally corrupt. These guys, Obama, the propaganda false story of 9/11 and all of this shit, since the Kennedy assassination is where I like to talk about it, you know, we've been subjected to a complete ruse. All these guys are psychopaths. They are complete. Everything they say is a lie. They're just, I don't know whether they're possessed or controlled by aliens, but you have to consider the possibility in some way. I don't anymore, honestly. I'm a gardener, but you have to if you're going to study carefully.
Yeah.
These guys are insane. There is an otherworldly audacity to their psychopathology. And
Well, I think it's easy to understand where they come from too, because, I mean, with a little compassion, you know, I don't definitely don't agree with what they do or anything like that, and I don't support it. But from where I've come from, I could see how it's easy to be scared of things you don't understand and to listen to other people that are also scared that agree with you and then put that judgment on other people that and things you don't understand. There's things that I don't understand and I continually judge, and what my experiences and the shock of it has allowed me to maybe step back a little bit better and to, not force my opinion on it as easily. But, it's just, I think people are kind of just people. They're scared and, they want to hold on to what they know. And when people come along and say, hey, what you believe is just not, it's not working out. It's not real. Then they freak out, So, I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't know, but I do think that we're on the precipice of something really astonishing happening to the planet and to human consciousness. And I don't really buy a lot of this 2012 hype, but I do sense there's a great quickening happening, and then sensing that in a lot of ways, in visionary ways, and talking with people and reading the newspaper. That something is about to shift in a very, very extraordinary way. And I think it has to do with extraterrestrials. I think that we're coming near a period kind of like when, like 1491 into 1492, where the prevailing story was that the Earth was flat. The intelligentsia knew that couldn't really be true, but that was still the official story. And then, because of this kind of breakthrough experience of Columbus, that that round Earth became part of the whole, spirit of the time, and something like that is about to happen. And whether it's cataclysmic or revelatory, well, it'll really be both, but that we're coming towards that.
I'd have to say that I agree with you, and that it, you can look at people that are fully, they're fully introduced or inoculated into like the thinking of the world right now, like the constant worldly thoughts, and they still feel as if they're completely honest, they still feel as if something is happening, something weird, something strange, and something exciting in a way too. So I can see where you can come up with that. One thing I was really interested in is and I've noticed is that a lot of people, younger generations, are looking to these people that you knew so well in the past, and they've kind of come and gone. These new people, the young people, are constantly looking for like a teacher, like somebody to come along and show them, hey, these are some things that you maybe should do in order to get where, I've been, or to understand things in a different perspective rather than just doing a bunch of, drugs or psychedelics and hoping for the best kind of thing. I have also felt this way. So you knew all these people and you're one of these people. What are some things that you would suggest, to the younger people to take in consideration when reading their material, through meditation, things like that, in order to get to the same maybe understanding of, you've gotten to?
Oh, yeah, these are great questions. Well, there's a very common tendency among people that are looking to expand their consciousness to project their idealized being onto some other teacher, whether this, happens in the form of transference in a psychotherapeutic relationship or whatever, but good teachers always, kind of try to kind of point that back, that cathecting back into yourself. And so, that's not to say that, I mean, it's been fascinating for me to meet these characters in my life, and I could tell stories about them. They're great historical figures in a way, and this unfolding of psychedelics in this century is one of the I think really if we do get a chance to look back at this period historically, it will be seen as some kind of renaissance, like the way we look back on the, Renaissance in the 1400s. So that's really fun and lucky. But they're human beings, we're human beings. I'm nothing special. I've just been lucky and having a lot of fun with it.
Do you think that maybe through your meditation practices really helped you out with maybe sorting through some of the things that you've seen or the things you've experienced through life?
Thank you for asking that. That is such an important question. I think that the best thing that I've contributed, I've been lucky to contribute, those are all good books that we've mentioned. But there's a chapter in the book Entheogens and the Future of Religion, which is a piece I did with my Buddhist meditation teacher, Jack Kornfield, on Vipassana meditation and applying that perspective to the use of psychedelic drugs. Hmm. And, I had many opportunities to take psychedelics when I was in high school and in college, and I never did until, and I consider myself lucky that I had that kind of meditative stance. And I always try to impart that to my friends that are getting interested.
Okay. And maybe what are some things that you've searched through, or searched for through your life that you've, come to know as maybe truths or something like that? Maybe say Robert Forte's, Four Noble Truths or something like that.
Well, I can't do any better than Buddha's Noble Truths. Those are really good ones. I'm a gardener now. That's the thing I like to do the most. I don't know if that answers your question, but
so garden is the one noble truth.
No, I'm gardening. I'm playing more music. I got very involved over the past decade or so in what some people call conspiracy theory and the political catastrophe that the United States has been affected to, almost unknowing, and how this unbelievably dramatic period in human history gets processed in the future is, sometimes I guess I think about it, but I was very involved in it for a decade, and now I like to garden. I think of it in along the lines of again, kind of Buddhist or Hindu Eastern thought that one of the great principles of liberation is the recognition of the quality of Maya and how the world is an illusion and getting involved in it is the cause of suffering. And so partly what we realize, we've kind of skirted on this a little bit when we talked about the conspiracy theories, but to realize how the whole edifice of contemporary culture is a construction by these puppeteers, that can be very, very awakening. And then,
And maybe even that, yourself is a puppeteer, like I'm a puppeteer of my reality in a way, kind of playing the game of Maya.
I don't really honestly play that much anymore. I did for quite a while. I put these books out. I was involved in the dialogue and the dance, but really not so much anymore. I play golf. I play with my plants. I keep a very, kind of limited sphere around me.
Yeah, your story kind of reminds me of the story of Siddhartha. I read that when I was in college, and that was a good book where he went on that journey. He was searching for answers, and he eventually came back to kind of where he started at the river. I'm sure you've read that book.
Sure.
Okay. Well, Robert, is there anything that any way that people can get your books or any websites or anything like that that you would you'd like to recommend for our listeners?
Oh, you just can Google my name, and there are a couple places. My books are available through Amazon or directly from the Inner Traditions website.
Okay, great. All right, well,
I have a kind of a token presence on Facebook. People can reach me that way, I guess.
Okay.
That'll be fine. Mm-hmm.
And then if they ever visit a California area, I guess they might get a chance to peek at you too, huh? All right. Well, Robert, thank you so much for being on our show today, and I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope that you have a great time working in your garden. I hope that one day I can be in the same place, relaxing, working in a garden my own. So, thanks again, Robert.
Okay, thanks for the interesting thoughts.
If you enjoyed this episode of Cosmic Echo and would like to learn more about Robert Forte and his work, you can visit our website at tailleaders.com/CE podcast, and there you can click on links that will take you to Robert Forte's book as well as his other work. Additionally, if you would like to support this podcast, you can click on our Patreon page, which is located at the same site. We look forward to bringing you additional episodes in the near future, but until then, happy dreaming.